A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and it's a big one. He's asking about trauma at the societal level. How do we heal it collectively, not just individually? He points out that disproportionate reactions to stresses often trace back to unresolved trauma, that we've gotten more aware of triggers as a culture. But the real question is, what tools exist beyond EMDR, and what's the actual scale of the problem? If you grabbed 100 random people off the street, how many are carrying significant trauma, and what kind? And then the harder layer, there's a public health interest in making this easier to treat, but the people who need it most are often the least positioned to pay for it. So where do we even start?
The numbers first, because they're staggering and they frame everything else. If you pull 100 adults off the street in the United States or most developed countries, you're looking at roughly 60 to 70 of them having experienced at least one potentially traumatic event. That's the exposure side. Of those, about 6 to 8 will meet criteria for PTSD at some point in their lives. But that's the narrow diagnostic lens. If you widen it to include significant trauma symptoms that cause impairment without meeting full PTSD criteria, and this is where the debate gets interesting, you might be looking at 15 to 20 people in that 100.
The majority have been exposed, but the minority developed the clinical condition. That gap is worth sitting with.
It's the whole ballgame. The question of why some people develop PTSD and others don't is one of the most researched and least settled questions in trauma science. We know some factors. Prior trauma exposure is a big one. It's cumulative. Social support after the event is enormous. Childhood adversity rewires stress response systems in ways that make adult trauma more likely to land as PTSD. Genetics plays a role. There are candidate genes related to serotonin transport and stress hormone regulation, though it's not destiny. And then there's the nature of the trauma itself. Interpersonal violence, especially sexual violence, carries much higher conditional risk of PTSD than natural disasters or accidents. It's not just the event, it's what the event means.
That tracks with what the prompt is getting at, the idea that a lot of anger and disproportionate reaction is trauma wearing a mask. If you've been violated by another person, the world becomes a fundamentally different place than if a hurricane knocked your roof off.
And this is where the diagnostic framework gets genuinely controversial. The DSM, the American Psychiatric Manual, currently on version 5 text revision, does not recognize complex PTSD as a distinct diagnosis. The ICD, the World Health Organization's manual, added it in the 11th revision in 2018, and it's been adopted across much of Europe and Asia. The split is not trivial. Complex PTSD captures something that standard PTSD misses, the effects of prolonged, repeated trauma, especially in childhood or situations of captivity where escape isn't possible. We're talking about chronic childhood abuse, domestic violence, human trafficking, torture, long-term refugee experiences. The symptom picture includes the core PTSD features, re-experiencing, avoidance, hypervigilance, but adds three additional domains, affect dysregulation, negative self-concept, and disturbances in relationships.
It's PTSD plus a shattered sense of who you are and an inability to connect with others in a stable way, which sounds like exactly the thing that would produce the kind of disproportionate reactions the prompt is describing.
It's exactly why the DSM's refusal to include it has real consequences. In the United States, if you don't have a DSM code, insurers don't reimburse for it. Researchers struggle to get grants to study it. Clinicians are trained on what's in the manual. So you have this bizarre situation where the rest of the world has recognized complex PTSD for years, and American psychiatry is still treating it as a footnote. The DSM committee's argument is that the existing PTSD diagnosis plus the dissociative subtype and the new prolonged grief disorder covers the territory. The ICD camp says that's like diagnosing pneumonia and tuberculosis as the same thing because they both involve coughing.
Of course there are.
The other piece of this is that complex PTSD responds differently to treatment. Standard trauma-focused therapies like prolonged exposure and cognitive processing therapy, which work well for classic PTSD, can actually destabilize people with complex PTSD if you don't do extensive preparatory work first. You can't just dive into the trauma memory and reprocess it when the person doesn't have basic emotional regulation skills or any stable relationships to return to between sessions.
The tools the prompt is asking about, they're not one size fits all, and the tool that works for a single incident adult trauma might backfire for someone with a childhood full of it.
Let me lay out the landscape beyond EMDR, because there's a lot. I'll group them roughly into tiers based on evidence base. Tier 1, the ones with the strongest randomized controlled trial support, cognitive processing therapy, prolonged exposure, and trauma-focused cognitive behavioral therapy. These are the workhorses. CBT focuses on how trauma distorts beliefs, things like, I deserved it, or the world is entirely dangerous, and systematically challenges those. PE involves repeatedly revisiting the trauma memory in a controlled way until the fear response extinguishes. Both have effect sizes in the large range, both are recommended by every major clinical guideline, and both can be delivered in 8 to 15 sessions. The VA has trained thousands of clinicians in these.
They're hard. Asking someone to deliberately revisit the worst moment of their life over and over, that's a big ask.
Dropout rates hover around 20 to 30%. It's not trivial, but for those who complete it, the results are robust. Tier 2. The ones with growing but not yet definitive evidence, narrative exposure therapy, which was developed for refugees and survivors of organized violence. It builds a chronological narrative of the person's entire life, weaving traumatic events into a coherent timeline. The idea is that trauma fragments memory, and reconstruction is healing. There's also present-centered therapy, which deliberately avoids processing trauma memories and instead focuses on current coping. It was developed as a control condition for trials and turned out to work pretty well on its own.
Which is fascinating. The thing designed to be the placebo outperformed expectations.
It tells you something about the power of being heard and supported, even without the exposure component. Then tier 3, the body-based and experiential approaches. Somatic experiencing, developed by Peter Levine, works with the physical sensations associated with trauma. The theory is that trauma is stored in the body as incomplete defensive responses, the fight or flight that never got to complete. Sessions involve tracking bodily sensations, noticing where tension lives, and slowly discharging that activation through small movements and awareness. The clinical evidence is mixed. Some studies show significant reductions in PTSD symptoms. Others show effects indistinguishable from time passing. But anecdotally, many trauma survivors describe it as transformative, especially for complex trauma where talking alone doesn't reach the thing.
This is the one where people shake, right? I've seen videos.
Tremoring is part of it, yes. The idea is that animals in the wild shake after a life-threatening encounter and then resume normal functioning. Think of a gazelle after a cheetah chase, and humans have overridden that response with our prefrontal cortices. Whether that's accurate neurobiology or a compelling metaphor is debated. But the experience of it seems to matter to people.
The gazelle doesn't have to pay $150 per 50-minute session to shake, though.
Which gets us to the access question. But before we go there, let me mention the newer frontier, psychedelic-assisted therapy. MDMA-assisted therapy for PTSD completed Phase 3 trials and was submitted to the FDA. The data is remarkable. About 67% of participants no longer met PTSD criteria after 3 sessions, compared to about 32% with therapy plus placebo. These are people with chronic, treatment-resistant PTSD, average duration of symptoms around 17 years.
Two-thirds of people who had been suffering for nearly 2 decades were essentially in remission after 3 sessions with MDMA. That's not incremental improvement. That's a step change.
It's unprecedented in psychiatry. The FDA had an advisory committee meeting, this was back in mid-2024, and the committee voted against approval, citing concerns about blinding, therapist misconduct in some trials, and the difficulty of standardizing the therapy component. The FDA ultimately decided not to approve it at that time, requesting an additional Phase 3 trial. Lykos Therapeutics, the company behind it, laid off most of their staff. It was a mess. But multiple other trials are ongoing, and MAPS, the organization that pioneered this work, continues to push forward.
The most promising trauma treatment in decades hit a regulatory wall over what sounds like procedural concerns, not efficacy.
The efficacy wasn't really in dispute. The concerns were about whether the trials adequately controlled for expectancy effects. People know they got MDMA because it's MDMA, and about a handful of cases where therapists crossed boundaries. Serious issues, but the question is whether they warrant blocking a treatment for a condition that kills people. Suicide rates in PTSD are 3 to 4 times the general population. That's the calculus.
The prompt mentions societal healing. MDMA-assisted therapy in a clinic is not societal-scale anything. It's boutique medicine for people who can navigate clinical trials or pay out of pocket.
That's the crux. Every treatment I've described, with the possible exception of narrative exposure therapy in refugee camp settings, is individual, professional, and expensive. The public health question is, how do you get the benefit of trauma healing to populations, not just patients? There are a few models worth looking at. One is task sharing, training non-specialists to deliver simplified versions of evidence-based treatments. The World Health Organization developed Problem Management Plus, which is a 5-session intervention for communities affected by adversity. Lay counselors deliver it. Randomized trials in Pakistan and Kenya showed significant reductions in distress. It's not full trauma processing, but it's something, and it scales.
5 sessions from a trained community member versus 15 sessions from a PhD. The trade-off is depth versus reach.
In populations where the alternative is nothing, that trade-off is easy to make. Another model is the trauma-informed community approach, changing schools, workplaces, and public services to understand trauma's effects rather than treating everyone who needs it individually. The idea is that if teachers, police officers, and primary care doctors know how to recognize trauma responses and respond without re-traumatizing, you prevent a lot of downstream harm without ever putting someone in a therapist's office.
That's the don't make it worse strategy. It's less glamorous than psychedelic breakthroughs, but it might do more for public health.
The Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration put out a whole framework on trauma-informed care. 6 principles, safety, trustworthiness, peer support, collaboration, empowerment, and cultural sensitivity. It's being adopted in bits and pieces across different systems. Schools are probably furthest along. There's a program called the Sanctuary Model that's been implemented in over 300 organizations. The evidence is modest but positive. Reductions in restraints and seclusions in inpatient settings, improvements in school climate.
We've got a menu. Evidence-based individual therapies, body-based approaches with mixed evidence, psychedelic treatments stuck in regulatory purgatory, task sharing for low-resource settings, and trauma-informed systems that try to change the environment rather than the person. What's the main truth hiding in plain sight that the prompt asks about?
I think it's this. The most common traumas are not the dramatic ones that make news. If you look at the epidemiological data, the most prevalent traumatic exposures in any given population are, in order, unexpected death of a loved one, witnessing death or serious injury, being in a serious accident, and then intimate partner violence and childhood physical abuse. The number one cause of PTSD in women is sexual violence. The number one cause in men is combat exposure, but unexpected death of a loved one is close behind. The thing hiding in plain sight is grief. Complicated, prolonged, traumatic grief. The DSM finally recognized prolonged grief disorder in 2022, which is progress, but we still treat grief as something you're supposed to get over on your own, maybe with a support group if you're lucky.
The 100 people off the street. Most of them have lost someone in a way that felt world-ending, and our culture gives them maybe 3 bereavement days and a casserole.
Then expects them to be productive. The other truth hiding in plain sight is childhood adversity. The ACE study, Adverse Childhood Experiences, was done back in the 90s by Kaiser Permanente and the CDC and has been replicated dozens of times. About 64% of adults have at least one ACE. 12% have 4 or more. The dose-response relationship with nearly every major health outcome is staggering. 4 or more ACEs doubles your risk of heart disease, triples your risk of depression, increases your risk of suicide attempt by 1,200%. And those are just the physical and mental health outcomes. It also predicts educational attainment, income, incarceration.
Trauma isn't just a mental health issue. It's a primary driver of health inequality, economic outcomes, and basically everything we spend money on as a society.
Which is why the prompt's framing of this as a public health interest is exactly right. The question isn't whether we can afford to treat trauma at scale, it's whether we can afford not to. And yet we keep funding the downstream consequences, emergency rooms, prisons, unemployment benefits, while underfunding the upstream interventions that would prevent or heal the trauma in the first place.
There's a political dimension here that's interesting. The prompt mentions that groups who've experienced collective trauma, ethnic groups, communities, might reasonably resist the idea of paying out of pocket to treat trauma that was inflicted on them. That's not just a practical concern, it's a justice concern.
It's where individual therapy models hit a wall. If your trauma is ongoing and structural, racism, displacement, occupation, no amount of cognitive restructuring is going to fix the external reality. There's a whole literature on historical trauma, particularly in indigenous communities and among descendants of enslaved people. The transmission mechanisms are debated. Epigenetic changes from maternal stress, parenting behavior shaped by trauma, cultural narratives of loss. But the phenomenon is real. You see elevated rates of depression, substance use, and suicide in communities that are generations removed from the original atrocities.
How do you treat a trauma that's not in the past? That's the challenge.
Truth and reconciliation processes are one attempt. South Africa's is the most famous, but there have been dozens. Rwanda, Canada, Colombia. The evidence on mental health outcomes is thin. Some studies show that testifying helps. Others show that it re-traumatizes. The benefit seems to depend heavily on whether there's actual accountability and repair, not just testimony. If you tell your story and nothing changes, that's not healing, that's just reliving.
The societal healing requires actual justice, not just catharsis.
Which is far beyond what any therapy modality can deliver. But there's a middle ground between individual therapy and national truth commissions. Community-based participatory interventions, where the community defines what healing looks like and builds it themselves. There's an example from Rwanda after the genocide, community-based sociotherapy, where groups of genocide survivors and perpetrators met regularly over 15 weeks to rebuild trust. It was led by trained community members, not clinicians. Reductions in PTSD and depression were comparable to what you'd see from individual therapy in a Western clinic.
That's remarkable. So the task-sharing model can handle not just individual trauma, but communal trauma with perpetrators in the room.
The key ingredient seems to be reestablishing social connection. That's true at every level, individual, family, community, nation. The neurobiology even supports it. Oxytocin, the bonding hormone, dampens the amygdala's fear response. Social support is one of the strongest predictors of PTSD recovery. The most effective trauma treatments all involve some form of connection to a therapist, to a group, to a coherent narrative of your own life.
If you had to design a public health approach to trauma, what would it look like?
Tier 1, universal trauma-informed practices in schools, healthcare, and criminal justice. Everyone who works with people in distress knows the basics. Tier 2, scalable, low-intensity interventions for people with significant symptoms. The Problem Management Plus model, delivered by trained peers and community health workers. Tier 3, specialist care for the people with complex or treatment-resistant PTSD, the full toolkit of CPT, EMDR, somatic approaches, and eventually psychedelic-assisted therapy when it clears regulatory hurdles. And underneath all of it, a funding model that doesn't require the traumatized person to pay.
Which means either insurance reform or direct public funding.
The VA system is actually the closest model we have. The VA provides evidence-based trauma treatment at no cost to veterans with service-connected PTSD. It's not perfect. Wait times are a problem, and the quality varies by facility, but it demonstrates that a publicly funded trauma treatment system is possible. The UK's Improving Access to Psychological Therapies program is another model, though it's been criticized for focusing too heavily on brief CBT and not handling complex cases well.
We have proof of concept, just not proof of political will.
That's really what it comes down to. The treatments exist. The evidence is solid. The economic case is clear. Untreated trauma costs far more than treatment. But the people who need it most don't lobby. They're dissociated, depressed, or dead.
There's a grim thought to sit with.
Let me pivot slightly, because the prompt asked about recurrent traumas in a population, and I want to give the numbers their due. If you take 100 randomly selected adults in the US, here's roughly what you'd find. About 30 will have experienced the unexpected death of a loved one. About 25 will have witnessed violence or a serious accident. About 20 will have been in the serious accident themselves. 15 to 20 will have experienced childhood physical abuse. 10 to 15 will have experienced sexual violence, higher for women, about 1 in 5. 8 to 10 will have experienced intimate partner violence. 5 to 8 will have combat exposure, and those categories overlap heavily. The average person with PTSD has experienced multiple trauma types.
The 100 people aren't sorted into neat buckets. Most people with trauma have been hit multiple times, often starting in childhood.
Which is exactly the complex PTSD picture, layered, developmental, interpersonal. And that's the population that standard short-term trauma therapy wasn't designed for. The evidence-based protocols were mostly developed on adult survivors of single-incident traumas. Rape survivors, car accident victims, combat veterans, they work for those populations. They're less tested and, frankly, less effective for the person who was neglected for the first 5 years of life, then bullied through school, then in an abusive relationship, then homeless.
The tools exist, but they don't all fit the same wound.
The field is slowly catching up to that. There's a treatment called STAIR, Skills Training in Effective and Interpersonal Regulation, that was developed specifically for complex trauma. It spends 8 to 10 sessions on emotional regulation and relationship skills before touching any trauma memory. Studies show it improves functioning and reduces symptoms even without the exposure phase, which is again telling us something about what complex trauma survivors actually need. They don't just need to process memories. They need to build capacities that were never allowed to develop in the first place.
That's a fundamentally different model. It's not healing a wound, it's building a self.
That takes longer and costs more, which circles us right back to the funding problem. Insurance companies love brief, manualized treatments with clear endpoints. They don't love rebuilding a personality over 18 months. But if you don't do it, that person cycles through emergency rooms, shelters, and prisons at enormous public expense.
The perverse incentive is to pay for the breakdown, but not the repair.
That's not unique to trauma. It's American healthcare in a sentence. But it's particularly acute here because trauma is so prevalent and so expensive in its downstream effects. There was a study in the American Journal of Preventive Medicine that estimated the lifetime economic burden of child maltreatment in the U.S. at over $400 billion. That's medical costs, lost productivity, criminal justice, child welfare, for 1 year's worth of incident cases.
$400 billion. And how much do we spend on child protective services and trauma treatment for kids?
The Federal Child Abuse Prevention and Treatment Act gets about $200 million a year. State spending varies, but it's not closing that gap. The ratio of downstream cost to upstream investment is probably 20 to 1 or worse.
The public health interest the prompt is pointing at is real, quantifiable, and utterly ignored in budget priorities.
Which brings me to something I think about a lot. The trauma field has gotten really good at describing the problem and pretty good at treating it individually. But we have almost no infrastructure for prevention. Most trauma is preventable. Childhood abuse is preventable. Intimate partner violence is preventable. Some accidents and illnesses aren't, but a huge chunk of traumatic exposure is human-caused and theoretically stoppable. And yet prevention research gets a tiny slice of the funding pie compared to treatment research.
Prevention doesn't have grateful patients who testify before Congress.
Prevention has people who never know what didn't happen to them. It's the ultimate invisible success.
If we're answering the prompt directly, the tools beyond EMDR include CPT, prolonged exposure, narrative exposure therapy, somatic experiencing, STAIR for complex trauma, psychedelic-assisted therapy and development, and community-based models like sociotherapy and Problem Management Plus. The main truth hiding in plain sight is that grief and childhood adversity are the most common traumas, not the ones we dramatize. And in any 100 people, 60-plus have been exposed, 15 to 20 have significant symptoms, and the most recurrent traumas are loss, violence witnessed, accidents, and childhood abuse, layered, not singular.
That's the summary. And the societal healing piece, It requires a funding model that doesn't ask the traumatized to pay, a workforce that doesn't all need doctorates, and a willingness to invest in prevention that will never produce a grateful patient to thank you.
One thing I keep circling back to. The prompt mentions that awareness has matured. Trigger warnings are now routine. But awareness without access is almost cruel. You tell someone they've been traumatized, you validate that their reactions make sense, and then you hand them a bill for treatment they can't afford.
There's a term for that in the field, trauma-informed without trauma responsive. It's the cheat version of caring. You acknowledge the wound, but don't provide the bandage.
The glockenspiel of corporate approachability.
And it's everywhere. Schools adopt trauma-informed language in their mission statements, but don't have a single counselor trained in trauma treatment. HR departments send out emails about mental health awareness, but offer insurance plans with $25 copays for therapy that no therapist in the area accepts. It's performative.
What would you tell the prompt's author? If you wanted to actually move the needle, where do you put your energy?
1. Push for insurance parity enforcement. Mental health parity laws exist but are widely violated, and state attorneys general could do a lot more. 2. Support the training of non-specialist providers, peer support specialists, community health workers, school counselors with trauma training. The workforce bottleneck is the biggest barrier to access. 3. Fund prevention research and implementation at something closer to the scale of the problem. Child maltreatment prevention programs like the Nurse Family Partnership have solid evidence and reach a tiny fraction of eligible families.
On the treatment side, keep an eye on the psychedelic pipeline, not because it's a panacea, but because a treatment that works in 3 sessions instead of 15 fundamentally changes the access math.
If you can treat complex PTSD in a week instead of 6 months, the cost drops dramatically and the workforce can serve more people. That's the promise. Whether it survives the regulatory and political gauntlet is another question entirely. There was a lot of excitement and then a lot of disappointment with the FDA decision. But the research continues, and other countries, Australia, Canada, are moving ahead with their own regulatory frameworks.
We're rediscovering something that was already being explored 40 years ago.
That's its own kind of trauma story, a promising treatment buried by the drug war and a generation of patients who never got the chance to try it. The field of trauma treatment has its own history of loss. And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1920s, along the coast of Labrador, it was not uncommon to encounter a fluttermonger, a traveling merchant who specialized exclusively in the sale of decorative ribbons and who was paid not in coin, but in dried capelin, on the understanding that the ribbons imparted a visual quality that made the wearer appear to move more quickly across the ice.
I have so many questions, and I'm not sure I want any of them answered.
That's going to sit with me.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, for keeping this show running. And thanks to everyone listening who's made it through 200 episodes with us. If you want more, find us at myweirdprompts.com.
See you next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.